Writer and director James Gray has made films set in unfamiliar places in recent years, Into the Jungle for The Lost City of Z, and Into Space with Ad Astra. But he was on familiar turf with his eighth feature, Armageddon Time, based on his own childhood in Queens. After a couple of bad experiences working with Harvey Weinstein and with Disney, which took over the final cut of Ad Astra, Gray has found a happier home. Focus Features chairman Peter Kujawski, widely known as Cujo, calls himself a gigantic fan of Gray's work, and he didn't hesitate to greenlight Armageddon Time. The film follows 11-year-old Paul Graff, a Jewish boy growing up in New York in the 1980s. Played by Banks Repetta, Paul happily attends public school until his parents, played by Anne Hathaway and Jeremy Strong, decide it's time for a change. For the first time, Paul finds himself wearing a private school uniform.
I look like a total idiot.
No, you don't.
I can't even have a normal knapsack.
A normal knapsack? Why would you want a normal knapsack when you can have this?
This is an attaché case. This is Class A1. This says, I am ready to work.
Just want me to be like you.
What?
You just want me to be like you.
No. No, big boy. I want you to be a whole lot better than me.
At a time when most major studios don't make art house films, Universal has stayed in the game with its Focus Features label. Today we talk with James Gray and Focus chairman Peter Cujo Kujawski about Gray's adventures in filmmaking and the business of making art house films. You, James Gray, you grew up in Queens.
That's right.
And you left.
That's right.
You got scholarship money and you were sort of like choked with the family experiences?
No, that's not really true.
That's not true.
I had dreamed of going either to NYU or to UCLA because Martin Scorsese went to NYU and Francis Coppola went to UCLA and they were my heroes. And so, of course, I wound up going to USC. But I loved the experience, but it was certainly culture shock, you know, when I got to Southern California in 1987, but never seen anything like that in my life.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
Yeah, I didn't have a car either. So that was an interesting
really
one.
You were really
stuck. I was stuck, although I learned the bus system pretty well. And also USC, it sort of encouraged maximum film nerd because they had this retrospective. I remember when I first got there, Burt Lancaster movies, and not having a car and also being unbelievably homely. I had no social life whatsoever.
I find that part hard
and,
to believe.
Well, trust me, it was rough. And I would just walk across the campus and go see movies. So my experience actually was pretty great.
And then, should I call you Cujo or Peter? I don't even know.
Yeah, you can call me whatever you're comfortable with. Everyone calls me Cujo.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone does it.
Cujo. I keep thinking of seeing a snarling dog, but you're not snarling and you're not a dog.
That's the great irony of the nickname.
That is the irony of the nickname, yes. You are a Philly native, and you went to work for James Shamus.
I did. I was a student of his.
James Shamus, I should admit, you know, the great independent film patron and sometimes maker.
Absolutely. A writer, producer, and full-time professor. So I was studying with him, and we got along really well. And I interned for Good Machine, which was his company at the time, which eventually I graduated and started working there full-time. And Universal bought Good Machine and became Focus Features. And I essentially learned pretty much all that I know from James Shamus and David Lindy as well, who was also part of Good Machine in that era and early part of Focus Features.
Right. You were sort of, I mean, don't be offended by my putting it this way, but you were sort of a suit, but you were interested in art film.
Yeah, I was always drawn to the films first and then figuring out a way to be involved with films that I felt were meaningful first and then making them work rather than being drawn to the movie business kind of as a business venture with, you know, producing the most finely tuned widget sort of version of it.
Yeah. But you didn't think I want to be a filmmaker.
No, I had in high school and college, those sort of aspirations of writing or directing and then did enough of it in that era to realize I would have been abjectly horrible at it. but realized in the early days of working with James that I loved what that part of the business was all about and finding people who actually had talent and actually had really interesting things to say and finding a way to sort of get that into the world and empower that and get that made.
You are borderline last man standing for a major studio with some kind of specialty label.
Sure. I mean,
we got Searchlight doing a lot of TV these days. Sony Classics, those guys are hanging in.
Yeah, I would say this. There's, I think, still a very strong community that's out there between some of the independent companies out there who are doing genuinely fantastic work with A24 and Neon and what they're all up to. And, you know, I'm certainly in the kind of position where I wear both points of view kind of every day as part of what I do, where, yeah, when it's time to compete with those guys and try to get whatever project it is that we want to make that they also want to make or things like that, then, of course, they're real competitors. But at the end of the day, I truly believe that the kind of currents that circulate that keep us all afloat come from the strength of the individual voices that they're bringing into the marketplace, and the kind of tone of each of those companies is different from what we do and different from what each other do and things like that, but yields an ecosystem that supports itself. And I certainly root for them every step of the way, because I think what we're all doing is very different than what kind of happens at the biggest, broadest, you know, kind of most mainstream studio level, which of course I love and am a fan of, but I think it's worth fighting for and preserving the kind of films that we all make as kind of quote unquote specialty films.
James, I'm going to do a total pivot. You had some close encounters with Harvey Weinstein, as have I. not quite the same, but I know you're a good mimic. I hear you do a good Harvey.
I mean, I do a good Harvey maybe because I have experiences. It's weird because I don't just say
movies,
this because
right?
He's here.
He's literally here on trial right now. Yes.
I know. It's
so
very
weird.
Odd.
Yeah. I mean, so I'm not mad at it, but it's definitely, for those of us who knew him in the glory days, it's like there's something hard to process about it.
There sure is. I don't just say this because he's sitting right here, but I had been scarred by Harvey, and I began to expect just worst case scenarios in all measured. Cujo's the opposite of that, the completely supportive of the creative team. And that's an amazing thing. But my experience with Harvey was, I had two, as you correctly put, the first time I went into it, the second time I had nothing to do with it.
He acquired your film.
Well, yeah, what happened was, the first time I just made the film with him, and that was insane. It was called The Yards.
And it
was insane. It was like, you'd sit down and he would say things like, I'm God's editor. I'm God's editor. I'm the best you've ever seen. Shakespeare in love. Life is beautiful. I'm the best editor you've ever seen. And you'd be like, what? You're an editor? You're running the company. And then all of a sudden he would give you a videotape when those existed. And he'd say, here's your movie. Enjoy. And you'd be like, what? And you'd watch the tape and it would be footage you shot, but it would be re-edited completely. And in my case, it was completely incoherent, the film. And I remember watching it with my good friend Matt Reeves, who is now a prominent director. And I remember, because he worked on the film with me, and I looked at him and he looked at me and he went, I can't make heads or tails. Can't make heads or tails. And
it was even a bad moment.
Oh,
yeah.
It was not the best. And then I remember calling Harvey. I said, Harvey, did you watch what I did? And I said, well, yeah, I got to tell you, I tried to take some ideas from it, but I didn't understand what was going on. That's the problem with you. Your mind is closed. Your mind is f-ing closed. You're a f-ing nothing. And this is the kind of conversation. I'm by the way, I'm like 29, right?
Yeah.
So I remember my reaction was like, I can't. There's nothing you can do, because it wasn't like a situation with him, which is excellent, where you hear an idea and you say, okay, or a note. And sometimes there's a great note, period. You just do the note and it works. Mm-hmm. And other times I find that underneath the note, the solution is wrong, but they are targeting something that's not working and you have to kind of rethink it. It wasn't like that with him. It was like, this is my edit. You know what I mean? It was like
megalomaniacal. Yeah.
Exactly. So I had real cognitive problems dealing with that version of a person giving me notes. Mandated, crazy, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So on the second film, I had made the film and I had Final Cut. So you, by the way, stop me if this gets a little dull or repetitive. But
I'm always here for a Harvey story.
Well, I know, but you don't want to sound like, you know, you're in the weeds about this and the specifics are crazy. But the film was purchased by Harvey without me knowing it. When I found out, I was apoplectic. And it was more of the same, you know. I remember him saying, he called me up. I was at home. He said, my daughter is born today. So I said, oh, congratulations. Don't tell me congratulations. I'm sitting here in the editing room and I'm cutting your movie. I'm doing this for you. I said, I'm sorry, you're in the editing room and your daughter was born? Yes. I said, well, I didn't ask you to be in the editing room. Well, I'm doing it for you. No, you're doing it for you. And I had Final Cut, so I told him, you know, basically,
you're doing it to me.
Yeah. I said, piss off. He said, all right, fine. Now, your movie's never going to be anywhere except for a Lifetime. Wow. And I went, okay. And then it became Chicken. And he didn't release it for a year. And then he finally did, as the great Jim Jarmusch once put it, your movie was released with tongs. You know, just put out there like this kind of horrible thing.
Dropped.
But it did come out and it won a bunch of critic stuff. And he kind of felt a little bit humbled, Mr. Harvey Weinstein, for about 19 seconds.
How long did that last?
Not long.
Coming up after the break, Peter Kujawski explains why James Gray's Armageddon Time was an easy yes for him. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to writer and director James Gray and Focus Features chairman Peter Kujawski about Gray's latest film, Armageddon Time, and the business of arthouse films. In Armageddon Time, Gray tells a semi-autobiographical story about his childhood in Queens, while touching on race relations and class divisions in 1980s New York. The film follows Paul, a lower-middle-class Jewish boy growing up in Queens. As Paul unhappily starts attending private school, he talks to his grandfather, played by Anthony Hopkins, about the kinds of prejudice he encounters.
They'll say bad words about the black kids.
Oh, yeah? And what do you do when that happens?
Obviously nothing, of course.
Nothing, of course, yeah. You think that's funny? You think that's smart? I'll tell you what I think. I think that's a crock of old horse. I said the bad words. You got a problem with that? Tough. I'm going to tell you now, you got to do something, you got to say something, okay?
While most big studios stay away from arthouse films, Focus Features chief Peter Kujawski gave Armageddon Time a quick and enthusiastic yes. Let's pivot to this excellent person, ironically called Cujo, who's not that guy. I don't know quite how it went down, actually, on Armageddon Time. Did you show him a script? What happened?
It was actually very simple and easy. James had written the script and started to put the film together all before the pandemic. And then the world shuts down in March of 2020, and the Cannes Film Festival film market that would have happened in May gets pushed and sort of recreated by the agencies as a virtual online thing. And Rogue Sutherland at CAA called me, this is maybe June or July, and said, I have something for you. It's going to be on the market, but I'm getting it to you early because I know you're the biggest fan, which is genuinely true. I've been a gigantic fan of James. And Rogue knew this was the first time that sort of I was sitting in a chair that allowed me to kind of say yes to something like this, that James had something that would be available this way. So took a look at it and you know, I was predisposed because of my fanship. The movie literally could have been about young James Gray just building a model rocket, and I would have wanted to do it.
If only you had known that.
I was going to say, I don't know anything about this. This is fabulous to hear.
and you know.
That's the next one. That's the sequel.
When you read the movie, you also just are immediately struck by the two things that I think the movie really is, which is this thing that becomes sort of universal because of how personal and how deeply specific it is about the world and the characters and the experience and the family and all those things. But it's using that as the doorway and the entry point to talk about a lot of things that should be talked about and should be discussed in this world of ours. And that at the time I was reading it for the first time, we're obviously right at the forefront of the culture, you know, in the summer of 2020 in brand new ways and ways that had a lot of energy about them, but also ways that weren't terribly subtle in the moment for all the good reasons that they weren't. And you immediately digest that James had created something that was actually pointing to a lot of the things in the culture that are hidden in ways that we don't anticipate or expect and are a little bit more insidious as a result of how some of these ideas can take root and take hold quite unintentionally. And it was just an easy yes at that point. And I remember getting on the phone with him for the first time and asking what part of the world he was in. And he said, I'm in L.A. at my house. And that was the first I'd learned he lived in L.A. And I said that was very off-brand for him.
yeah, it is a little.
And
seemingly.
And that was that. From then on, it was just an easy question of trying to support him to make the best version of what he wanted to make possible. And I think he did it admirably.
That's lovely. I can say, by the way, I live in Los Angeles because of Harvey.
Away from New York.
Yeah, I had moved back to New York after college, made three pictures there, four. And then in 2012, after the immigrant experience, I'd had it. And my wife said, well, why don't we just try Los Angeles for 6 months? And then it's like the La Brea tar pits, you know, the mammoths
out.
Of get caught in tar and we couldn't get out. And the kids got into school and that was the end of that. So that's why I live here. But I didn't know any of that. So or I know a tiny bit of that. So that's lovely to hear. I myself was filled with terror about ever being able to make the movie. So I've come at it from a very different point of view than Cujo does. So it's funny
it's
to
personal.
Hear that. Yeah, I mean, it's like you write this thing. I wrote it in a kind of gilded cage in 2019. I was doing an opera in Paris. I was doing Marriage of Figaro, and I'd never done an opera, and I was enjoying it. I loved working with the singers and the conductor. It was a fantastic experience.
Shades of Billy Friedkin.
Oh, I spoke to Billy Friedkin at length about his experiences. I hoovered his brain, to put it politely, about what I should do. But I was still a bit adrift, and I would go home. My wife and children were not with me yet, and I would go home to this fantastic apartment, but it was in a very residential neighborhood in Paris. I'm sure I had some measure of culture shock. And I just started to work on it. So this was before, you know, January 6th, obviously, and Trump's contesting the idea of democracy itself. And of course, before George Floyd and Black Lives Matter, I just was trying to do something personal that I remembered that frankly upset the hell out of me. And it wound up getting more clear to me as the time went on, given the events, rather than less.
Mm. Funny how that happens sometimes.
Yeah, strange. That's luck. Or not.
Yeah, I read that your mom died, sadly, not that long after you moved to L.A.
Yeah, well, she got sick right before I left for college. And then I had to make the decision about whether I would go away to school or not. And maybe to this day, I have some question about whether I should just try to go to NYU. But I would not have been, my parents could not have afforded NYU. So I probably would have then been, I had to give up that. It was a free education.
But what I was going toward is, and I don't know whether your father's still in the world or not. But
no, he died. He died actually fairly recently, about 2 months into the edit
of
COVID.
What I'm wondering is, like, you're writing about something that's clearly based on you and your family. How do you deal with the voice in your head saying, oh, you know, that might make this one look bad, or this person might get mad at me, or, you know, because this is something I wonder about when I read authors writing about their families.
I'm going to confess something to you, which is not altogether lovely to say, but my father, when he died, which, as I say, was in the middle of editing, I was on very good terms with him. We were not estranged. And I'm very sad that he died, and my children in particular really do miss him. He was a wonderful grandfather. But I feel a slight measure of relief that I didn't have to show him the movie. Mm. And my attitude was always, I have to show the whole thing. And if they don't talk to me ever again, it is what it is. So that's what you have to do. You have to leave that concern aside.
So did you tell him, I'm making this thing?
Of course I did. But my father was he was like three quarters emotionally repressed engineer, one quarter I'm getting older and trying to find what my mortality means, you know, that toward the end. And I think he sort of only semi-processed what it was I was doing.
Oof, my mother would have a breakdown. You cannot tell family secrets.
Well, I'm sure, by the way, that that's what my mother would have said. Mm-hmm. She would have been appalled.
I mean, not even secrets. Don't make us look bad.
Of course, of course, right? Of course.
That you went through various potential actors for this.
Right.
De Niro, Sutherland, Kate Blanchett, Oscar Isaac. When you ran this process, what did you do?
Well, you mentioned a bunch of actors. The reason for that, by the way, is simply COVID. The schedules of everybody kept shifting and moving around, and whether we could get insurance for production, it became like an impossibility. And then, I mean, it was a very difficult. It's gotten, I hope, easier, but it was in 2020, 2021, It was nasty to try and get the movie, especially because of the way we did this, which was a negative pickup. You had to try to figure out insurance and bond, and some people wouldn't even bond a movie that had, you know, COVID problems. And oh my God, it was just a complete mess.
Nightmare, yeah.
Yeah, so all the actors, everyone's schedule. I mean, in the case of Cate Blanchett, Kate was supposed to do just one day for me as Marianne Trump.
Right.
And Kate was very excited. She said, I'm going to get my hair. It's going to be absolutely very high. Beehive. I'm going to get a marvelous wig. I have the perfect person. And then all of a sudden, she couldn't do it. Why? Because...
Tar.
She was in Berlin. By the way, she was a total trooper about it. She was like, I'll do it on the weekend in a green volume and we'll find one in Berlin. I'm like, no, don't worry about it. I'm not going to direct you remotely in the volume, you know?
Right.
But that's the reason. And what I tried to do, first of all, Annie and Jeremy, they look and act basically exactly like my parents did. I mean, it's that simple. I didn't ask them to do a kind of Rich Little impersonation, and they always wanted more photographs and more research, and I was always, no, I want you to absorb it and absorb the soul, not to do an imitation, and it becomes something else. And of course, what happens is they wound up doing exactly what my parents would do in a given situation, and I don't understand that at all.
That must have been very weird to watch.
Oh, it is weird. It's like, I liken it to like, a very, you know, those Beatles cover bands. It was originally like Beatlemania on Broadway. They'd say, not the Beatles, but an incredible simulation.
Right.
It was sort of like watching the Beatlemania version of my parents.
Right.
Very weird.
Right. Very weird. James Gray wrote and directed Armageddon Time. Peter Kajowski is the chairman of Focus Features. The film is in theaters now. Thank you guys both so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Matt Schwartz, Katie Gilchrist, and Paul Smith, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business, as well as other great KCRW podcasts, on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.